Good morning. Today is Friday, December 3rd, and you're listening to the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm your host, Taylor Chalstrom. On this episode, you'll hear information about the economic outlook for the 2022 almond pollination season from Brittany Goodrich, Assistant Professor of Cooperative Extension in the UC Davis Department of Agricultural and Resource Economics. After that, we'll review today's national and regional news, and we'll finish off the show with information on spring insect management for walnut orchards. We'll dive in right after this.
Being a member of the California walnut industry means working together to advance the industry through advocacy, research programs, and promoting walnuts with smart, cost-effective marketing, activities that are often too big for one operation to tackle on its own. There are unique ways the California Walnut Board and Commission deliver value. For example, health research gives consumers more reasons to believe in walnuts, while new and improved walnut varieties and production methods increase profitability, and it ensures the issues facing our industry are in the front of government decision makers. Learn more at walnuts.org.
The amount of pollinators required for a given almond season depend on the amount of current acreage. UC Davis's Brittany Goodrich said that acreage expansion is beginning to plateau.
There's about 1.3 million bearing acres of almond orchards in California, and roughly about 3% of those are in self-fertile varieties. And so to estimate the approximate demand for colonies for almond pollination, I use 2 hives per acre for traditional varieties and then 1 hive per acre for the self-fertile varieties. And so what that comes to for this year is about 2.63 million colonies that are going to be demanded for almond pollination. And that's just slightly up from last year, where we were at right around 2.6 million colonies. And so, like I said, we're sort of starting to see some of the self-fertile acreage, the lower demand from those orchards starting to kick in, so that our demand isn't increasing quite as rapidly. But that's a good thing, because even still with the self-fertile acreage, so as of January 1st, 2021, there were about 2.92 million colonies in the U.S. So our almond pollination demand is roughly 90% of all of those colonies in the U.S. So we're still using a very large portion of the total colonies that we have available.
Goodrich said that self-fertile varieties make up about 20 to 25% of new plantings. However, self-fertiles still only make up about 3% of total bearing acreage.
It kind of remains to be seen how that's going to impact the industry. But I did want to note that there has been studies. I know Dr. Elena Nino here at UC Davis is working on some self-fertile pollination studies. And there have been other ones that actually show that there's a pretty substantial yield bump when you have bees in self-fertile orchards. So contrary to maybe some people's belief, you should be putting bees out in your orchards, even if you have some of these self-fertile varieties like Independence. So chances are, if you haven't been putting bee colonies out there, you're likely borrowing from your neighboring growers. And so that's probably not making them very happy. And so I sort of see this, if we keep trending towards these self-fertile varieties, I think what's probably going to end up happening is that maybe some of these traditional variety growers are going to have to start stocking more colonies per acre to make up for the self-fertile growers not stocking as many. So it's probably not going to have that much of an impact on the actual demand for honeybee colonies.
Total production cost of pollination compared to other facets of an operation, such as irrigation, nutrients, or pest control, typically takes up a similar share. This number has been changing in recent years, though.
The last couple of years, there have been relatively low almond prices, so growers are very, like, you know, cost conscious about how much they're spending. And so our most recent cost and return studies that are the Ag and Resource Economics Department puts out for almonds were done in 2019. And so at that time, pollination costs were roughly about 15% of annual operating expenses. And so just to give you an idea, or give growers an idea about how much that is, In comparison, harvest costs were about 17% of annual operating expenses. So really, pollination costs are right up there with harvest costs, irrigation, and labor. So they really have been increasing as a percentage of operating expenses. I mean, back in like 2002, pollination expenses were really only around like 7 or 8% of operating expenses. So they've sort of doubled. And primarily that's due to the pollination fees. And so, I mean, just to give you an idea about what pollination fees are looking like. So I did a survey recently of commercial beekeepers. And on average, the pollination fee that they got last year for 2021 almond pollination was around $192, $193 per hive. Back in 2017, I looked back at the California State Beekeepers Association survey. That number was around $184 per hive. So we've really seen over the last 10 years or so just a pretty steady increase in pollination fees, pollination expenses, and a lot of that is just purely due to the higher demand from the increasing acreage of almonds.
Pollination costs can also be affected by environmental factors. The summer of 2021 brought on yet another bout of drought, and that might have lasting effects on beehive supply in 2022.
This is going to be an interesting year, and especially because, you know, we obviously saw the drought here in California, but what's going to be, what I see is going to be the, you know, more, the bigger issue for almond pollination specifically is there was a pretty severe drought in major honey producing states. So these are states, North Dakota, South Dakota, Montana. I think USDA estimates that like 60 to 70% of our honeybee colonies are in these areas specifically for honey production during the summer months. And so these were areas that were hit really hard with drought this past summer. And what that means is that, so when there's no rain, there's clearly, there's not going to be any or very few flowers. So that means there's going to be a limited supply of nectar and pollen out there for the bees to collect. And beekeepers can feed their colonies sugar syrup as a substitute for nectar and pollen, but it's really just not as good of a nutrition source for them. So what beekeepers will be seeing most likely, and I did attend the California State Beekeepers Association meeting 2 weeks ago now, and they were talking about how it's looking pretty not great for their colonies because it's going to affect, you know, colony health. They may be having high winter mortality rates in their colonies. So that means that there's fewer colonies available. And then another big thing is that they're not having, you know, that revenue source from the honey produced. And so when they don't have those additional revenue sources, they may not have operating capital to be investing in pollen patties and transportation to get to almonds. And so there's a lot of potential impacts for some disruptions from the drought in these major honey producing areas. So I guess I would just recommend growers, if you haven't talked to your beekeeper yet or your pollination broker, you should definitely be checking in with them.
Goodrich recommends that if a grower hasn't checked in with their pollinator provider or broker, then to do so as soon as possible. This ensures that growers get the pollination they need for their orchards. Goodrich has been working to obtain information from beekeepers in the form of a survey to see their needs as well, and got some great insights.
One of the big things that I've been thinking about is, and I think almond growers themselves have probably been thinking about, is considering the use of bee-friendly cover crops in almond orchards. So I really wanted to look at this because there's a lot of potential soil health benefits for growers, but then there's also a lot of bee health benefits as well if we plant these flowering types of cover crops. So I wanted to get some insights on beekeepers' preferences for these different cover crops. So I just asked about, primarily we focused on the Project APSM seeds for bees cover crop varieties. And we asked beekeepers, you know, just in general, what their thoughts were. And I think we can both imagine that overall beekeepers really prefer any type of, you know, bee-friendly cover crop that's planted. But what I found really interesting was that they had a very strong preference for so some like brassica type cover crop mixes that are consist of different mustards and canola, because these are going to be cover crops that actually bloom earlier or have the potential at least to bloom earlier in the season, which is going to help out tremendously, especially during that time period when the bees are here, but the almonds haven't started blooming yet. So there was this overall preference. So if growers are considering, you know, taking the extra expense and planting some of these bee-friendly cover crops, definitely choose a mix. It doesn't have to consist of all, you know, mustards. Project APSM has a soil builder mix that has, you know, mustards and legumes and different types. So you get like different soil health benefits, but the beekeepers overall really preferred those mustard type mixes. So that's something to consider.
Goodrich also asked beekeepers in the survey about ways that they usually arrive to mutually beneficial agreements with growers and what factors play a role. She was surprised to find out that pesticide lethality toward honeybees was a recurring issue.
Anytime bees are located near agricultural land, there's always this risk of pesticide exposure. So I was fairly surprised to learn that. I asked about pesticide exposure in the last 2 years to almond pollination season specifically, and over half of the beekeepers had some sort of sublethal type of pesticide exposure to their colonies. So that means the colonies themselves are not killed outright, but they may, you know, experience developmental issues down the road. And about 20% of the beekeepers surveyed had a lethal pesticide exposure where their colonies were actually killed in the last 2 years. So I thought that was interesting in that, you know, the almond industry has done a really good job of putting out the honeybee best management practices. And I think that it's important for growers to be aware that pesticide exposure is a real risk for beekeepers when they bring their colonies to almonds. And so following those best management practices and you know, just communicating with the beekeeper, because oftentimes it may not even be the almond grower themselves that creates the pesticide exposure. It could be some, you know, grower of a different crop that's nearby. So I think, you know, really keeping that communication open is important to maintaining some of these longer term pollination relationships.
There are a multitude of ways that growers can lower pollination costs when negotiating with beekeepers. Cover crop implementation, advanced payments, and pesticide lethality clauses are good methods for doing so.
Some beekeepers will give discounts if growers plant cover crops. Another one is giving beekeepers some, at least part of the pollination fee in advance. So we had over half of the beekeepers said that at least one of their growers actually provides some advance payment for pollination. And that can be another mechanism that, you know, you pay half of it up front. So they give you a $2 per hive discount or something like that. And then putting things like different pesticide, I call them clauses. I know a lot of growers and beekeepers don't have formal written agreements, though I would highly recommend that. However, just, you know, talking to your beekeeper and making sure you're on the same page about pesticide applications is another way to, you know, maybe potentially get some sort of a discount, or at least make sure that you're securing that beekeeper for the next few years. And so then another way to look at decreasing some of these pollination expenses is actually looking at your hive density and colony strength requirements. So we didn't get into it, but basically in my survey, I asked a lot about the different colony strength requirements that there were, and you can see that if you have higher colony strength requirements, you're going to pay more per hive, versus if you have lower colony strength requirements, you're going to pay less per hive. And so what growers can do is they can either, you know, require most of the growers and beekeepers are agreeing on these 8-frame colony strength requirements. So one way to reduce the amount you pay is to drop that down to a 6-frame requirement. It's a little bit easier for the beekeeper to meet. And so they, you know, can be paid less money for that, those colonies. Or another way is to actually, you could pay for higher strength colonies, but stock fewer hives per acre. So maybe instead of, you know, 2 hives per acre at an 8-frame average, you drop down to 1.8 hives per acre at a 7-frame average or something like that. And so what's important to say about that is that crop insurance requirements do sort of dictate, it's still a little gray area there, but they do dictate that you have to have some minimum level of bees per acre for your pollination to make sure that you can actually collect an indemnity if you do have a loss. So what they say is the sort of standard is 2 6-frame colonies per acre or its equivalent. So you could even do 1 12-frame hive per acre and it would still meet that that, you know, pollination requirement for crop insurance. So that's another way to do it. I highly recommend, like, I'm an economist, so I, you know, think about just like substituting these things, but definitely talk with like a farm advisor or you know, even your crop insurance agent to make sure you're still meeting that minimum requirement and you're still able to collect if that's a problem for you.
In terms of what pollination costs will look like after the end of the 2022 season, Goodrich said there are still many uncertainties.
It's still sort of up in the air what's happening with total almond acreage with the last, you know, couple years of drought. And then also we have the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act that might be leading to fewer acres of almonds. I mean, we've seen plantings slow down from recent years. A lot of that has to do with the water uncertainty and then also with relatively low prices right now. But I guess the thing I'm reasonably confident in is that we probably won't see pollination expenses going down anytime soon, just because we're, you know, we're using 90% of the colonies already. It's hard for beekeepers to keep their colonies alive. So we're going to have to keep paying these relatively high pollination fees to bring that many colonies here for almond pollination. So I'm reasonably confident in that. And I don't think we're going to see any sort of rapid decrease in fees anytime soon. So I think it's really important for growers to be maintaining these relationships with their beekeepers, knowing that I always try and highlight this, that the lowest fee is not always the best fee because you don't know what you're getting. Sometimes you may have an unreliable beekeeper for that, you know, lowest fee, or you may make your current beekeeper angry and they may go find somebody else that'll pay a higher fee. So I think it's really important for growers to sort of keep that in mind, that they need the beekeeping industry, just like the beekeeping industry also needs them. So it's a good reciprocal relationship there.
That wraps up today's Pollination Outlook segment. We'll be right back with today's national and regional news after this.
Soil fumigation is a critical step to ensure that your orchard gets off to a good start. Trichlor is a pre-plant soil fumigant and is the foundation for a successful pest management system. Targeted pathogens include soil-borne disease and nematodes. Fumigation helps to create a healthy soil environment that allows the plant's root system to flourish. For more information about Trichlor or to schedule an application, contact Trical Incorporated at 669-327-5076 or visit www.trical.com.
We're back with today's national news. USDA is making some changes to crop insurance rules for hemp. USDA's Gary Crawford has more.
In the world of crop insurance,
everybody is very interested to hear how we're going to cover hemp.
That's Marsha Bunger. She runs the USDA's Risk Management Agency, which has been trying to offer crop insurance products for hemp. And it's not easy because the crop is new to the U.S. and
it's ever-changing and evolving.
And so insurance programs have to do the same. And this week, USDA is announcing some changes to hemp crop insurance. One, for example, is that up to now, for you to collect indemnities for your hemp crop damaged by weather, for example, you still had to go out, harvest the crop anyway, take it to the processor, and the loss is determined there. Marsha Bunger says not anymore.
Now the adjuster can go out and look at the crop and says there is no value here for whatever reason. And then that can then determine, yes, here's your loss payment.
There are other changes. You can see them at rma.usda. One thing not changing, if your crop is over the limit on THC content, that's not an insurable loss.
More from USDA. United States drought coverage has now exceeded 50%, USDA's Rod Bain reports.
Unfortunately, with a warm, dry November in the books for the vast majority of the country, the drought news is not particularly good.
With total drought coverage in the continental U.S. now at over 53% as of November 30th, according to USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey. That's up 5.6% from November 2nd.
This also extends a streak that has been going on since late 2000, where we have seen a large number of consecutive weeks with more than 40% U.S. drought coverage. In fact, we have now reached 62 weeks at that threshold, going all the way back to late September of 2020.
Rippey adds he expects that drought monitor era consecutive week record to be broken in January, as La Nina has established itself over the U.S.
What that has meant is that we have seen warmer and drier than normal conditions across roughly the southern two-thirds of the United States,
with much of the Southwest remaining warm and dry into early next year.
Today's regional news comes from Almond Alliance of California, which recently named Audrey Betancourt as its new president and CEO. She currently serves as Director for Sustainability for the California Cattle Council and Western United Dairies and has extensive experience dealing with a wide range of California agriculture and natural resource issues. Betancourt succeeds Elaine Trevino, who has been nominated by President Biden to be the Chief Agricultural Negotiator for the U.S. Trade Representative. Trevino is awaiting a confirmation hearing before the U.S. Senate Finance Committee. Betancourt said, quote, "I am excited to join the Almond Alliance, a dynamic leader in American agriculture. As a fourth-generation California farmer, it is a personal honor to serve. I look forward to working with this team to keep farmers and processors providing economic opportunity to our rural communities, bringing worldwide the highest quality product from our farms to your table," end quote. Betancourt assumed her new role on Wednesday, December 1st, 2021, and will work out of the Alliance's Modesto office. That was today's regional and national news. We'll be right back after this break, and you'll hear from University of California Cooperative Extension's Jalunja Rajal about spring insect management for walnut orchards.
Soil and Crop Incorporated is your number one resource for sustainable nutrition. Growers are faced with difficult challenges, and Soil and Crop Inc. has the experience, fertilizer, and biological portfolio to dramatically increase yield and performance in your troubled orchards and fields. Contact Soil and Crop Incorporated today for a free consultation on how we can help reverse the challenges you face as a conventional or organic grower so you can increase your bottom line and become a better sustainable farmer. Contact us today at 559-564-1236 or visit our website at www.callnrg.com. Soil and Crop, putting nature to work for you.
As the tree nut industry awaits for their orchards to exit the dormant season, it's important to think ahead. UCIPM advisor Jalunja Rajal says that walnut growers and managers need to be prepared to monitor and suppress insect pests in the spring before they cause economic damage to the crop. Rajal named some pests that growers should be concerned about in the central part of the San Joaquin Valley.
So specifically, if we talk about walnuts, then of course, we're talking about major pests. For example, carding moth, navel orangeworm, early part of the season, also the aphid. There are two different species of the aphid that can be present on the leaf. And then a little later, early summer, at that time, then we'll also talk about the spider mites, walnut husk fly, Pacific flat-headed borer, and those are some of the major pests that will appear there. So pretty much, major insect and arthropod pests and mites begin their activity in the spring.
Rajal explained what a spring management plan looks like for walnut growers, and of course, an integrated pest management approach will be key.
The main mantra of the pest management is by following the integrated pest management approach, IPM approach. And so simply it's the pest management approach where we'll utilize the information that are related to the pest biology, pest ecology, its seasonal occurrence, population threshold values, and use all of those information to make a pest management decision. So to make whether we need to treat or not, if we need to treat, and for any specific pest or pest complex, then we'll think about what are the management tools we have available. And so basically integrating the management as well as its biology and ecology of the pest together is a part of the integrated pest management. And of course, majority of the crop in California commercial production system, we follow those IPM principle, knowingly or unknowingly in many cases. The other aspect about management, the IPM based management, is that IPM suggested to include non-insecticidal method, for example, cultural control, biological control as much as possible when feasible. And then of course the pesticide is the part of the program, but it will be also need to be integrated along with other options out there. One example I want to give you is that if we think about navel worm germ control, we're not just specifically talking about navel worm germ and, you know, its mortality. We're talking about how other factors, for example, navel worm germ in walnuts specifically, if you think about early part of the season, they will not be able to do the damage on the fruit by themselves because they will not be able to penetrate into the fruit at that time. But if there are carling moth pressure and the carling moth infested fruit out there, blighted nuts out there, or the sunburned nuts out there, then navel worm germ basically utilize that avenue to go in and does damage. So in that case, we need to kind of look at it as a holistic approach, not just the one specific insect. And so in that case, I think that's the right term that we want to use is management. Overall management of the pest out there, pest complex, is the best strategy to go in that regard. So that's a little bit about how we use the IPM as a tactics, as a sort of approach to manage the pest in the walnuts and other crops as well. And you mentioned that as far as planning of this pest management goal, you know, the planning is basically it's year round. If we start think about just after the harvest, we need to think about, well, what was my damage the last year look like? What are those numbers? And, you know, this different block I had is higher pressure in navel worm germ or carling moth damage, it looks, you know, higher in that area, what I should do for next year. So that harvest sample right there, that information gives an idea for what we should do next year. And when you go into the winter, then we need to think about, you know, dormant insect pest management, kind of monitoring of the dormant season pest, for example, scale insect and things like that nature. Of course, if you go further into the winter, then we need to think about how we can manage navel worm germ by doing the winter sanitation, removing all these mummy nuts from the trees as well as from the ground, and get rid of those nuts that are already infested with the navel worm germ larva in those nuts. So that would be the part of that. And if we move to the spring season, we begin to think about how we can monitor effectively these all different insects using the traps, using the other sampling tools and tactics that we have, and kind of season begins that way, and we'll keep continuing doing that until we start taking again harvest time, taking the sample, harvest sample, and again another year begins. So it's pretty much like a very interesting thing is that, you know, it's never ends, right? But I think after the harvest, you start begin the planning for next year, and it's keep going that way.
While the major insect pest burdens for walnut growers include navel orangeworm and coddling moth, there are other pests to be aware of as well.
Walnut aphid, and there is also another aphid species called the dusky vein aphid. So these are also the important pests out there. Majority of the cases in majority of the orchard, these aphid are under control with the just sort of natural biological control. The one thing that we need to really careful about that early part of the season is not to disrupt those parasitic wasp activity, so that aphid population would not blow up if we, you know, if we kill the parasitic wasp at that time. And so selection of the insecticide at that time that will favor aphid parasite, parasitoid, is really important, very important consideration at that time. If we don't disrupt that, the aphid population in general, they will keep under control. So we don't need to any sprayer and things like that. But also we can evaluate or monitor their population out there using the leaflet samples. So in UCIPM, again, outline that very clearly, but the main idea is that taking about five, this first subterminal leaflet of the walnut leaf, and at least from the minimum from the 10 trees, if we take that and all that together becomes a 50 leaflet. So five leaflet from the 10, from one tree and then total 10 trees, so that 50 leaflet. And basically looking those leaf under microscope or using the just a hand lens and see whether there is presence of the aphid, you know, both dusky vein as well as the walnut aphid, will be able to see it under that. And so that provides a good idea about, you know, the pressure of these pests and out there also. Another pest that we need to think about at that time is the spider mites. The spider mites is kind of common pest across the many different crops, of course, in all nut crops. And there's kind of more or less similar way of monitoring goes for that spider mites also. Take about 50 leaflet from 10 different trees and representative sample and look for the mites, their predator, specifically six spotted thrips and other predators out there on those leaves. And based on that, we know whether, you know, there is active presence of the predators, it's keeping the population low certain level, or is it something disrupted there? And so these are the kind of two additional pests that that we are also kind of looking and doing the monitoring in the springtime, in addition to navel orangeworm and coddling moth.
Walnut trees don't produce as many mummy nuts as almond and pistachio trees do after harvest, but Rizal said winter sanitation of mummies for controlling navel orangeworm is key regardless.
If we do every year sanitation and maintaining that orchard and try to keep that population lower every year, do whatever we can in terms of other integrating these cultural as well as these non-chemical tactics together, that will keep that navel orangeworm population below all the time. And then there we will have very low risk that exploding population explode in the future. So I think it's a long-term vision having about the holistic approach of the integrating the multiple tactics to manage multiple pests would be, I think that should be my kind of thinking that will going forward in the future. And I think, and I'm sure that, you know, all the pest control advisors, consultant, growers are completely agree with that point. And there is sometimes the economics part involved, sometimes other factors involved, but in the long run, I'm hoping that we'll going to that direction, that integrating different tactics and tools so that we'll have this long-term management of these pests in walnut orchards.
That about wraps up our show today. Thank you for listening. This is Taylor Chalstrom reporting for My Ag Life.
Salty, closed soils can render your crops unproductive. DSAL, formulated by AgroPlanté, is specially designed for sodic and saline sodic soils. DSAL will displace sodium and wash it out of the root zone with irrigation to enhance your soil structure, water penetration, and vitality by decreasing soil salinity. AgroPlanté's DSAL flocculates your soil to promote soil aeration and drainage. With DSAL, you'll create a better soil environment for your crop roots and optimize yield. Contact AgroPlanté today to find out more at 559-498-0388 or visit us at agroplanté.com.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcasts, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.